Good evening, everybody. We have a special edition tonight, a special learning session, because, God willing, tomorrow night is the holiday of Shavuot. We begin that holiday, beautiful, beautiful holiday. It's very unique this year. Two unique aspects. Number one is that Israelis are stuck keeping 2 days. Normally, in Israel, they only keep 1 day of the holiday. This year, they don't have a choice. Because when the holiday ends Friday night, that same moment begins Shabbos, and there is no time in between. So they go from Yom Tov right into Shabbos. So technically, they're keeping 2 days straight. But the uniquer aspect of it is the way the calendar falls this year is the exact same calendar of the year it actually happened over 3,300 years ago. The Jewish people, when they left Egypt, the actual Exodus, they left on a Thursday. They left on a Thursday. And you fast forward and you go those 7 weeks and you get to the Mount Sinai. The Torah was given on Shabbos, right? Technically, 50 days would be Friday and Shabbos. So these are the 2 days that this year work out perfectly, exactly the way it was over 3,300 years ago. So pretty cool. Friday, Shabbos. Okay, that being said, I wanted to share with you tonight an important idea that comes out that really gets to the, I think, the heart of the matter when we talk about Torah. Let me start with the following. We all celebrate Shavuos one way or another. Most of us probably associate it with a dairy meal, whether it's cheesecake or blintzes. We do it for a variety of reasons. However, the Talmud tells a very interesting story. The Talmud says that every year for the holiday of Shavuot, Rav Yosef, that was his name, Rav Yosef, he would say to his attendants, he would say to those who worked for him, he would say, please prepare for me a tasty calf. I want meat. Why? Listen to his words. After all, if not for this special day, how many Yosefs would there be in the marketplace? He would say, we have to celebrate, take the time and to recognize that this holiday of Shavuot, this holiday of the giving of the Torah, is a transformative day that changed who I am, changed who we are as a people. Therefore, we should have a festive meal. Go ahead, prepare for me a delicious meal, a most delectable calf, and prepare it. Why? Because if not for this day of Shavuos, the giving of the Torah, again, his words are, how many Yosefs would there be in the marketplace? In plain, simple English, how would you translate that? How would you say, if not for this special day, then use it in your plain, simple English. How would you say it?
How many Jews would be in the marketplace?
No. What is he trying to say? That if not for this day of Shavuos, then I'd be like anyone else in the marketplace. I'd be, forgive the term, but the average Joe. I'd just be like anybody else. What differentiates me from Joe Schmo walking down the street is the fact that I'm part of a nation that accepted the Torah. And I live a certain lifestyle, and that differentiates me from everybody else. That's what I think the Talmud is telling us. That Rav Yosef said, we have to recognize this amazing day called Shavuot, because if not for this special day, how many Josephs would there be in the marketplace? However, if he meant to say what I'm suggesting, that he'd be an average Joe and like everybody else, I think he would have said it a little differently. The great leader of my yeshiva, Neri Yisrael, here in Baltimore, who passed away right before I came to the yeshiva, was a man by the name of Rabbi Ruderman. Levi. He was the Sichos Levi. Rav Levi Yitzchak Ruderman. Rav Ruderman asked this question. He asked, why didn't Rav Yosef, we'll just call him Rabbi Joseph, Rabbi Joe, okay, why didn't he say, if not for this special day, I'd be like any other Joe in the market? But that's not what he said. He used an expression that says, how many Josephs would there be in the market? Seems a little funny way to say it. Listen to what he proposes. But to appreciate this answer, we have to take a step back. Let's review a story of a different Joseph, a different Yosef, the biblical Joseph that we know from the story of him and his brothers, right? We're familiar with this story. What's the story? The story goes that Jacob, our patriarch, has 12 sons. Number 11, his name is Yosef. His name is Joseph. And what happens? He's given certain preferential treatment by his father, which certainly has a certain ire in the eyes of his brothers, and it irks them. And sure enough, the day comes, Joseph is 17 years of age, and he is sent on a mission by his father to go check how his brothers are doing when they took the sheep out to graze. So he went to go check on them. And the story goes that the brothers see him coming from a distance, and they say, ah, this is our opportunity. Let's get rid of him once and for all. He keeps talking about these grandiose dreams that he had about all of the sheaves in the field bowing down to his sheaf and all of the stars bowing down to him. He's got these crazy notions of taking over leadership in the family. Let's get rid of him now. The brothers debate this a little bit, and ultimately they decide that they're not going to kill him, but what they're going to do is they're going to take that fancy coat, the coat of many colors, the technicolor dream coat, and they're going to slaughter an animal, and they're going to dip it in its blood and bring it back to their father, saying, Joseph was devoured by an animal. He's dead. He's gone. Meanwhile, what they do is they sell him down to a bunch of merchants who are heading down to Egypt. We all know the story. The story goes, he's down in Egypt. He becomes the servant of a man named Potiphar. Potiphar's wife, let's just say she likes him. She wants him. And she basically frames him. You like that? That was very subtle. And she basically frames him. She makes a proposition. Joseph wants no part of it. He runs out, but she grabs his jacket, grabs a coat, grabs a shirt, whatever it is he was wearing. And she's left with a piece of it in her hand. And instead of it being what really happened, she claims he came on to her and she was able to fight him off. And here, behold, he's thrown into prison for this heinous act of attacking Potiphar's wife. And he languishes there for 12 years until the butcher, the baker has his dream and the wine steward has his dream. And okay, long story short, he's taken out and Pharaoh has a dream and he interprets it. Right? We all know this story. Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Fast forward to the very end. The end of the story is Joseph is now second in command and there's a famine, but Joseph had come up with an economic plan that Egypt now was the center of prosperity and any of the neighboring countries that want to come, they have to buy the food that Joseph had prepared and saved. Fine. The brothers, unbeknownst to all of them, they turn to their father and they're saying the famine has hit hard in our neighborhood in Canaan. We have to go down to Egypt. So the father, Jacob, says, fine, the 10 of you go. Leave the youngest one, Benjamin. Let him stay here with me. You guys go down. So they go down. Joseph recognizes them. They don't recognize him. Fast forward. He gives them a hard time. He sets them up. He says, I'm not giving you food anymore until you bring Benjamin down. They bring Benjamin down. He gets framed for stealing the cup, the goblet from Joseph. And long story short, this is the pivotal moment. Judah comes up and he says to Joseph, you cannot leave Benjamin here. He cannot be taken here. It's going to have such a terrible effect on Dad. And finally, Joseph is moved. He is moved that he has to reveal himself. The Torah tells us the following. Joseph says to his brothers, I am Yosef. I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? But his brothers could not answer him because they were left disconcerted before him. The brothers were shocked. This is Joseph? Oh my, OMG. Big fat letters. How can, they have no words. They're shell-shocked. But Yosef says, I am Yosef. And he asks the obvious question. It's been 22 years that he's been gone. And he asks, is my father still alive? Seems like a very legitimate question. He has no idea. He has no contact whatsoever. But wait, before you get into the story further, we have to note a very important Rashi quotes from a Midrash. Rashi on that verse, one of the great commentators, Rashi, can't learn anything in Torah without Rashi's commentary. It's just that good. Nobody can learn. We always joked in yeshiva, how did Rashi learn without Rashi's commentary? Like, how does he do it? It's like, how did he do it? It's impossible. But that's who Rashi was. Amazing. Rashi quotes the Midrash and says that on this expression where Yosef says, I am Yosef, is my father still alive? Says the Midrash, ay vey, woe is it to us on the day of judgment. Woe will it be to us on our day of judgment. For if the brothers couldn't answer the rebuke of Joseph, their younger brother, how much more so will we be overwhelmed by God's rebuke of us when in the future he rebukes each one of us according to our deeds? Says the Midrash, take a look. The brothers had no answer to the rebuke that Joseph gave them. Ay vey on all of us. What are we going to say when God rebukes us for our actions? It's a great point, but I have a very simple question. Where was there any rebuke? Where did Joseph send any rebuke? He said five Hebrew words, Ani Yosef, and he asked the question, Ha'od Avi Chai? I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? Question mark. Where does the Midrash see anything about Joseph giving him rebuke, giving the brothers rebuke and telling them off? That the Midrash says, take note of this, because if the brothers couldn't answer their younger brother, Joseph, oy vey, we're in deep, you know what? What are we going to say when we have to answer to God? This is the question that is asked by many, many commentators. Listen to this. If you really want to appreciate this, I have to tell you a story. Tell you a story. It's a short story. It's from a great writer known as Isaac Basheva Singer. Some of you may have known him, his works, great Jewish author, poet. He tells the following story. He tells the story about two guys living somewhere in Europe. Small town, as they were many places throughout Europe. And one of them says to his friend, you know what? I'm getting older. I have got to go see the big city. I'm going to go to Vilna. Vilna, it's a big city. I want to go see what the real, you know, how they live in the city. We're a bunch of people living out in the country in the boondocks, a small little shtetl. I want to see what the big town looks like. Okay. His friend wishes him well, and he goes, and he's gone for about 2 weeks. Finally, upon his return, he goes, sees his friend, and his friend says, no, tell me, uncle, how was it? What was the big city like? He says, oh my gosh, it was unbelievable. On the first day I was there, I met a guy, and he was so patriotic to his country. He was singing songs about Russia, Vilna's in Poland, right? Wherever it is. And he's so patriotic, and he was waving the flags and great. And the next day I went out and I met a guy, and he was waving a flag for a revolution against the government. This is terrible, the atrocities and blah, 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 blah. And then you know what? On the next day I went out, I met a guy who was studying and learning Torah, and he was so focused on his spiritual pursuits. And then I went out the next day and I met another guy. I met a guy. He was so entrepreneur. He was scheming how to become so wealthy in business. And he's describing all these things. And his friend stops him and he says, Yankel, that's the big city. Different strokes for different folks. You have all different kinds. You got a guy who wants to be patriotic and another guy who wants the revolution. He's against the government. One guy who's focused on Torah learning and one guy who's in business. And one guy, his friend looked him straight in the eye and he goes, no, you don't get it. It was the same guy. This is the story he tells. You know what Yosef was telling his brothers? Listen to this insight. Let me ask you a simple question. Did, yes or no, did Joseph know whether his father was alive or not?
No.
You would say no. It's been 22 years. Yes. He's had no conversations whatsoever. However, I would have agreed with you, except I very conveniently left off the paragraph right before Joseph reveals himself. I never told you exactly what the argument was that Judah made that put Joseph over the top to finally he couldn't control himself anymore and he had to reveal his identity. What did Judah say that moved Joseph to the point of revealing his identity? So I want to read it to you. Listen to Judah's words to Joseph. He's recounting the history of when they first came down and how they asked this leader, meaning Joseph, we had asked him for food. Then your servant, my father, said to us, you know that my wife bore to me two sons. One has left me and I presumed, alas, he has surely been torn to pieces, for I have not seen him since. So should you take this one too from my presence, meaning Benjamin, and disaster befall him, then you will have brought down my old age and evil to the grave. And now, if I come to your servant, says Judah, if I come to your servant, my father, and the youth is not with us, since his soul is so bound up with his soul, Jacob and Benjamin are close. This is the only remaining child from Rachel. It's gonna have such a detrimental effect on Jacob. It will happen that when he sees the youth is missing, he will die. And your servants will have brought down the old age of your servant, our father, in sorrow to the grave. For how can I go up to my father if the youth is not with me, lest I see the evil that will befall my father? This is Judah's argument to Joseph. Have mercy. Take into consideration, I have an old father. I promised him I would bring Benjamin back safely. Because remember, he didn't come down the first trip. You told us we had to come down with him. If I don't return with Benjamin, it's going to kill Dad. And at that point, Joseph is so moved, he can't hold back any longer, and he reveals his identity. I ask you the question again. When Joseph revealed his identity and he said, I am Joseph, is my father still alive? Does that question make any sense anymore?
No, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't. Does he know whether his father's alive or not? The answer is?
Yes, he knows.
Yes, he does. He just heard an entire passionate plea from Judah of what negative effect it's going to have on Jacob. So what is his question? Is my father still alive? He's asking for confirmation. He's not going to get it by asking the question. He'll say, oh, I am Joseph. Let me see Dad. What kind of question? There's no question. If I ask you a question, I expect you, because I'm lacking information, I'm expecting you to fill in the gaps in my knowledge. Give me the knowledge I need to answer the question. Wayne, does Joseph know whether Jacob is alive at this point? Yes or no?
Well, he was alive when they came down.
He just got through saying, if you keep Benjamin, that was just a couple of days ago. What is he asking? Judah's not going to have any more information than when he left.
Right.
So he knows the answer is yes, as far as everybody knows. So then what's his question?
Is he asking, is he still alive? Like spiritually, is he still Jewish? Is he still keeping the traditions?
Why would he ask that question? Why would that be in the foremost part of his head to ask whether Jacob, his father, is still religious? I mean, why would he think otherwise? Jacob is the patriarch of all patriarchs. I mean, this is like, he wouldn't be asking that kind of question. How about I change it a little bit? I'm just going to change one simple punctuation. Instead of it reading, I am Joseph, is my father still alive? Question mark. Picture the scene. Joseph has his hands on his hips and he's looking his brothers right in the eyes and he says, "Hey, I'm Joseph. Yeah? Is dad still alive? Exclamation point." What does that mean? Joseph is calling out his brothers that they are hypocrites. They are so hypocritical. You see, 22 years ago, when you guys decided that I was not worth saving, I was going to be sold, and you were going to make some cockamamie story up to dad, did you take into consideration the impact it would have on dad then? Did it even cross your mind about the detrimental and negative effect it would have? I was very close with dad. And you didn't consider that? And now you come to me and you want me to have mercy. Oh, be merciful on Benjamin. It's going to hurt dad. Really? I'm Joseph. Remember me? Is dad still alive? Did he survive then when you sold me? You inconsistent hypocrites. Oh, how's that for rebuke? He shot him right between the eyes. He can't possibly be asking, "Oh, is dad still alive?" an informational question. He knows the answer. But rather, he turns to them and he says, "You want me to have mercy?" You using the argument, which is a legitimate argument, that it's going to have a negative impact on our father? Then how come you didn't do that? Same exact logic when it came time to selling me. I'm Joseph. Yeah? Is dad still alive? Did he survive when you did this to me 22 years ago? Oh, he did? Then don't come to me now crying, "Oh, it's going to hurt dad." That is the ultimate rebuke. How dare you? You're inconsistent and you're hypocritical. Come on, tell me you never understood that story that way. Yeah. Me neither until I heard this insight. It changed my entire perspective. I grew up like you did. Yes, he hasn't seen his father, but it makes no sense in the context. He's told clearly the entire trip he keeps hearing about. Dad, and dad sent us down with 10 brothers, and dad, and this, and dad sent us back, and he wants us. He knows the answer. But he looks at them, and he gives them the rebuke that says, "You're hypocritical." When it works in your favor, that's when you care about dad's feelings. When it doesn't, then you ignore it, and you only care about you. I'm Yosei. Remember me? Did dad survive? Is he still alive? Yeah. Nice try. There can be no greater rebuke than being inconsistent in your own behavior. That is the story of that guy who goes to Vilna. The guy goes ahead and he sees the same guy. And one day he's patriotic. And the next day, nope, revolution against the government. One day it's all about spiritual pursuits. And the next day, nah, it's all about making money. There's no consistency. There's no consistency whatsoever. Today, this is important. This is my main principle. This is my moral compass. This is what I need to be. And you know what? The wind blows a little differently tomorrow. It's like, I don't know. Maybe it's like that. What happened to the morals and values of yesterday? Eh, that was yesterday. That's hypocritical. Says Rabbi Ruderman. Ah. He says, let's go back to that piece of Talmud. The piece of Talmud we started with that said every year on the day of Shavuot, Rav Yosef would say to his servants, "Prepare for me a delicious meal. Because if not for this special day, how many Josephs would there be in the marketplace?" The wording is very precise. He's talking about himself. Do you know how many versions of Yosef there would be? You know how many versions of me there would be in the marketplace? However many days there are, that's how many different versions you'll see. There will be no way to be consistent because today this is the values. It's like ties, wide, then thin, then wide. Paisleys are out. No, paisleys are back in. It's whatever the way the wind blows in Paris, that's what we do here. Why? Again, I'm oversimplifying it, but the message he's saying, if not for this day of Shavuos, where we got a Torah, where the Torah gives us a guide to be consistent in my principles, regardless of what the wind blowing, regardless of what society now all of a sudden thinks is in vogue, the Torah doesn't change. The Torah, the value system of love your fellow like yourself, and the laws about looking at agriculture and giving tithes and appreciating one day a week that you put aside your business efforts and you keep Shabbos and you have a way of eating, not only what you eat, but how you eat. Those never change. It teaches us to be consistent in life. I have my set of values. Ah, the world tells me this is now acceptable. I'm not so sure. Because you know what? In 20 years from now, it's going to flip. The pendulum's going to go the other way. And then all of a sudden, that's not in vogue anymore. Torah teaches me consistency. This is what Rav Yosef was telling us. We should celebrate the holiday of Shavuos because without it, not just I would be the average Joe. More than that, I myself, how many versions of me would there be? Because now this is what's important. Next year, it's something else. Third year, it's something else. I mean, we all know people like this, of where this is their battle cry. I've been fighting for this for years. This is the cause, right? And then you meet them a few years later and like, well, no, I mean, that was important, but this is really the thing. Okay. And then a few years later, it's another thing. And they go from thing to thing to thing to thing. I'm not talking about leaders who can do project after project. I'm talking about a basic core values. This is what it's all about. And they're screaming from the rooftops. There's no consistency. The Torah teaches us that there needs to be, the name of the game is day in and day out. Stay consistent. It's a beautiful idea. As hard as it may be to understand, when someone else points out, like in the story of Joseph and his brothers, where someone points out the hypocrisy, there's even a deeper level to this. Let me tell you another story. Again, a story that's taken straight out of the books of Tanakh. And this is the story with King David. King David had married this woman, Bathsheba, Bathsheba, whatever you want to call her. Okay. And it was not done in the most upright and clearly transparent way. It was a legal loophole that he used in order of marrying this woman. Technically, he didn't violate any law, but it was not appropriate the way he did it. And God does not like it. Okay? Listen to what happens here. The prophet tells the following. Uriah's wife heard that her husband Uriah had died, and she mourned over her husband. The mourning period passed, and David sent for her and brought her into his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. The deed that David had done was deemed evil in the eyes of God. Hashem sends Nathan, the prophet Nathan, to David. He came and told him the following story. He said to him, there were two men in one city, one rich and one poor. The rich man had very many sheep and cattle, but the poor man had nothing except for one small ewe, okay? One small ewe that he had acquired. He raised it, and it grew up together with him and his children. It ate from his bread, drank from his cup, and lay together with him and his family. It became like a child to him. A wayfarer came to the rich man. He was reluctant to take from his own sheep or cattle to prepare the visitor who had come to him. So he took the poor man's sheep and prepared it for the man who had come to visit. You hear this? The rich man has a visitor and he doesn't feel like reaching into his own his own flock. So he takes the one sheep, the one shepsela that belongs to the poor guy. David, the Navi tells us, the prophet tells us, David was very indignant about this man. And he said, as God lives, any man who does this deserves to die. And he must pay fourfold for the sheep because he did this deed and because he had no pity. You hear this? David rules that a man who behaves like this should be punished. That is not proper behavior. He should be punished. He should be fined. All of these things should happen to him. Drum roll, please. Nathan says to David, Atah Ish, you're that man. You. Thus said God, I have anointed you as king over Israel, and I saved you from Saul's hand. I gave you the house of the Lord, the women. I gave you money. I gave you all these things. And now the sword shall not, and he gives him a punishment. You, David, are that rich man. You have everything. You have power, prestige, money, wives, children, whatever you can imagine. Uriah had one wife. That's all he had. And you went ahead and you arranged it such that he would die at the battlefield so you can take his wife. Atah Ish, you're that man in the analogy, David. Folks, this is even harsher rebuke. This isn't Joseph telling his brothers what he did wrong. This is he jeopardized himself. What's the word I'm looking for? He prosecuted himself when he said, oh, that man, he did a terrible thing. He should be punished. Whing! Turn it right around and look in the mirror, King David. That's just what you did also. You just signed, sealed your own fate. When the hypocrisy stares us in the face, there is nothing that stings more than that. Nothing. To be hypocritical is bad. But when you're called out on it, and it's right in your face, not by someone else, but you yourself recognize that. Yeah, that's the ultimate rebuke. What are we going to say when God turns to us and says, yeah, you didn't have time to learn? Really? Then how come every night you stayed up till 2 or 2:30 or 3 o'clock watching Netflix? You couldn't find a half hour to study a little bit? You didn't have any money to give tzedakah? Really? Then how'd you go on vacations every 3 months? Oh, you didn't have the knowledge. Well, you went to the library and you brushed up on it. Oh, you didn't have the... What are we going to say? No, I didn't have... We're standing before God. No rationale is going to fly. That's the ultimate rebuke. And that's what the Midrash Rashi quoted on Joseph and his brothers. Imagine if the brothers had no response to the rebuke of Joseph. What the heck are we going to say when we stand before God? We have to learn to be consistent. We have to be understanding that if it's, you know, what holds true for if people come to me, it's hard. I only play a rabbi on TV. In my real life, I'm just a regular guy.
Sure, sure.
People come to me and they ask me, what should I do about X, Y, or Z? And I tell them what I think is the right answer, right? There may be a point in where I face a similar question. Now, I came down and I told them, I think that they should do X, Y. They should do X, right? Which was a harder path for them. But I thought it was the right thing to do. And then I faced the same challenge and I'm like, well, you know, it's not really that bad. You take it, you know. I'm going to get called out on that. I tell one person one thing and I tell myself, take the more lenient way. Doesn't work that way. That's inconsistent. The Torah teaches us that we have to be consistent. It's more than it teaches us that we have to. The Torah teaches us to be consistent. I want to make my words very precise here. The beauty and the advantage of having a Torah is that it teaches us that we can be consistent in all that we do. We learn to be careful with what we speak. The mouth is amazing. It's the only organ on your face that has two safeguards. It has your teeth and the lips so that you have two protections. Your eyes only have your eyelids. Your ears only have the flap at the neath, you know, that you can cover it with, right? The nose is a nostril, you close it. But your mouth, your tongue, to speak has two safeguards, says the Talmud, because it's the most dangerous organ. What we say. It's so easy to be hypocritical with the way we speak. Rabbi, I try really hard not to speak Lashon Hara. Meanwhile, as soon as the class is over, man, did you see what Liz did? It was unbelievable. I'm just picking on you for no reason, right? I mean, that's like, seriously? We all are guilty of these things. The Torah has to teach us that we need to be consistent. Not just that others don't call us out, but we don't incriminate. That's the word I was looking for. We don't incriminate ourselves with our behaviors. But here's the second half to this. You with me so far? This is a fabulous understanding of what it is we're celebrating by having a Torah. We celebrate the fact that we have a guidebook that allows us to be consistent and not just choose our ethics and values based on whatever whim of society happens to be at any given moment. But you could rightfully turn back to me and say, Rabbi, oh, you know what? Before that, before you pick on me, one great insight here also. Let's talk about the Torah. We know that when we were given the Ten Commandments, they were on two stone tablets. Where were they put? Where were they kept? Nobody walked in. Moses didn't walk around for 40 years holding that thing, right? That's not the way to do it.
In the ark.
You put it in an ark. You put it in what we call the Aron, the Ark. Now, what was the Ark made of?
Gold plated around the side. Had all kinds of designs, as I remember.
Okay, but what material?
Wood, I would think. Wood was, where'd they get the wood? But I thought it was wood.
You said it was gold.
Well, trimmed. I remember the description of it goes into all the things you put on it, as I recall. If I'm remembering it right from the description when we read that in the Torah and trying to get the Raiders of the Lost Ark out of my head. But no, I remember when we read it. In fact, I think I've got
the
a book.
The Ark actually were three boxes, one within the others. One, the inner one, then an outer one, and then a further outer one.
Mm.
The most inner one and the most outer one were plated with gold. They were all wood, but the inner and the outer were plated with gold. The one in the middle was not plated, and it stayed wood. Okay, you got that, Fred? Make a note of it, because it'll be on the final.
Okay.
I really done myself wrong. Okay, go ahead.
What, Alma?
We didn't get it. You froze.
No, we heard it.
Oh, I'll say it again. The inner one and the outer one were, all of them were wood, but the inner and the outer were plated with gold, and the middle one in between was stayed wood, not plated. Okay? The Talmud wants to know, who cares about the most inner one? Nobody ever sees it. What a waste of gold. No, you'll say, come on, that's the one that actually houses the tablets. That should be the most prestigious, even if nobody sees it. The Talmud gives a fabulous answer. Talmud says that it's teaching us an amazing lesson. That those who represent Torah, or let me say it better. If you want to know what the Torah's description of a person is, they need to be solid gold inside and out. Inside and out. You can't be one way outward and portray this virtuous person that you are, and yet inside, behind closed doors, you're a stinking you-know-what. Or, when nobody's looking, I can do it this way. No, 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 no. The Torah teaches us that it needs to be gold. Not just because on the outside it looks that way, but meanwhile, inside it's nothing. No. Your inside needs to match your outside. So Liz is like, then why not the middle one? I see it, Liz. I see the gears turning. Good question. The concept of wood, by the way, why was it not hammered out of solid gold? Why does it have to be gold plated? Is because wood is the material that represents, it comes from trees. Trees are the perfect symbol about growth. It's all about growth. Torah gives us the ability to grow beyond ourselves. So you want to retain that aspect of wood. But the Torah teaches that it should be gold. Not just because when I go outside and everybody has this great impression of who Rabbi T is. And meanwhile, you come home, I come home, and everybody's like, I don't know why they think that you are the worst possible. I'm kidding. Relax. Right? But the goal is that there be consistency both inside and out. The terminology that the Talmud uses is tocho kibaro. Inside should be like the outside. It should be consistent. And that's why the ark itself, from within and from without, are to recover it with gold. Okay? Now, there could be one major drawback to being consistent. I know it sounds simple, and you know, and we all, I don't think I'm telling you anything new and novel. We all know that consistency is a very important aspect of who we are as a person. It shouldn't be a facade. It shouldn't be fake. It should be real. That should be the real me inside and out. But there could be a pitfall. There could be a downside. What could the downside be? That if you do the same thing over and over and over and over again, with no change, and you just do it again and again and again and again, it becomes mechanical. It becomes robotic. Take me, for example. Not that I like to be the example, but I think of everybody here, I probably have put on tefillin the most consistently every day, just about. I can't say I never miss, but Baruch Hashem, since my year that I was bar mitzvah, which is years ago, that I have put on my tefillin just about every single day. And you know what? It gets hard after a while. Not hard to put on because it becomes a routine and it's really simple. But the thought, the mental state of I'm about to perform a mitzvah in the Torah, I'm going to put on tefillin. And when I make the bracha to do it, I should be thinking, this is a great opportunity. I'm doing a mitzvah. But instead, it's at a very early hour of the day, very early hour of the day. And I'm rushing to get to shul on time. And I put on my talis, and I'm wrapping on the tefillin, I'm putting it on. And of course, my mind is thinking of 13 other things that I got to do before 7. And I got to reach out to this one. I got to make a note of this. Meanwhile, I'm putting on the tefillin, and everything's great. I haven't thought about the tefillin once. Because it's become so mechanical, I do it again and again and again and again. So Rabbi, it's a great lesson you're teaching about consistency, and the Torah teaches us that. But don't you run the risk of it just becoming by rote? It's a great question. I'm glad you asked. Hale, you had the question? Sure you did. I had you. You were thinking this question, I know. It's a good question. And it is difficult. It is a challenge. I'll tell you this. There's a midrash that asks a very simple question. The midrash asks, what is the phrase? Let me find the exact terminology. One second. I want to make sure I get it right. Hold on. It asks the question, which verse in the Torah best describes the greatest principle in the Torah? Cite me a verse in the Torah. Quote me a verse somewhere that is the best, that really expresses the greatest, most fundamental principle in the Torah. And there's three opinions that the Midrash brings. The first one, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Hear, O Israel, Hashem is our God, God is one. The oneness of God. That is the principle of all principles. That's first opinion. Second opinion says, no, it's V'ahavta L'Re'acha Kamocha. Love your fellow as yourself. That's the ultimate principle, greatest principle of all time. Those are the first two opinions. Then those two I can work with. I think we can all agree those are two majorly fundamental principles. But now comes a third one that totally throws us for a loop. The third opinion says, no, it's the verse that says that every single day, when we read the wording, where's the third one here? Here, one lamb you shall offer in the morning and the other lamb you shall offer in the evening. It's talking about the daily sacrifice that was brought in the temple. The fact that it was brought, it had to bring two two of these animals, one in the morning and one in the evening. That is the greatest principle in the Torah, says the third opinion. Huh? The fact that they would bring an offering in the morning and an offering at night, in the evening, what is that? I would argue that Shema Yisrael, the first opinion that says, Hear, O Israel, that's all about recognizing your relationship with God. I'm good with that. There's one God in this world, indivisible, runs everything, blah, 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 blah. Faith. Second opinion, it's all about social interactions. Love your fellow as a self. In Yiddish, be a mensch. Be a good person. Treat people properly. I'm good with that. But then you come to this third opinion that's talking about some crackpot idea that you have a sheep in the morning and a sheep at night. Yay! That's my principle for the greatest principle in the Torah. So the commentaries talk about this and they say, no. You know what's unique about the third opinion?
Consistency.
Talks about what?
Consistency.
That's exactly what it is. It's consistency. You see, the first opinion is all about faith, not action. Belief. Right? The second opinion is all about action, how you interact with people. The third opinion says it's neither just belief and faith, nor is it just action. It's both of them, but on a regular basis. It's consistency. How many days a year was that offering brought? 365 days a year. Not 350, not 340, not even 352. 365 days a year. You want to know what the greatest principle in the Torah is? Learn all the lessons and do it day in and day out. The act of continuity, practice again and again and again and again. Yes. Is there a concern it will become mechanical? I'll deal with that in a second. But if you want to know what is the greatest principle, it's not the Superman, the Superman hero who comes in and rushes into a burning fire and saves the baby that one time. That's not the superhero in Judaism. The superhero in Judaism is the guy or gal who does it consistently, who's working on themselves to speak properly to people, who consistently, I know people who learn, as I've said many times, something called Daf Yomi, learn one page of Talmud a day. They will not go to sleep at night, no matter what time it is, until they do that page. And they do not miss every single day. That's the hero, the one who can do it consistently. But you say, but it's hard. Yeah, it is. The challenge, one second, Sharon. Yeah, go ahead. You'll do you first. Go ahead, Sharon.
Okay, I was going to say, but there's a difference of doing something consistently and doing it with the same feeling you did it the first time you did it.
Correct. And that's the hard part. I can consistently do it, but am I going to stay focused and keep it fresh? That's what you're talking about, right? Yeah, that is what I'm talking about with the challenge. The goal is to be consistent, but how do we keep it fresh? How do we keep it alive? King David himself faced this challenge. And in Psalms, he actually says, one thing I ask of God, thus this shall I seek. Would that I dwell in the house of God all the days of my life, to behold the sweetness of God and to visit his sanctuary. He wants one thing out of life. King David wants one thing, to dwell in the house of God all the days of my life, to behold the sweetness of God, and to visit his sanctuary. Aren't those two terms mutually exclusive? I'll say it again. I'll put the emphasis on the right syllable so you don't miss it. Okay? One thing I asked of God, that shall I seek. Would that I dwell in the house of God all the days of my life, to behold the sweetness of God, and to visit his sanctuary. What does dwell mean?
Stay in, be at.
Stay there. That this is where I set up shop. I'm here. This is where I live. I dwell. What is visit?
Go
periodically, not dwell. Well, make up your mind, David. What do you want? Do you want to dwell in the house of the Lord forever? Or do you want to just come visit on, you know, every other Tuesday? What do you want? The commentaries point out that David is telling us the key to this. I want to dwell, but I got to come up with a strategy that I have that same feeling as if I had just come to visit. That's new. It's fresh. That's the challenge. How do I keep it fresh? How do I keep it new and that it not be mechanical? The prophet Ezekiel, the prophet Yechezkel tells us that if you entered into the sanctuary using the northern gate, you were to leave using the southern gate and vice versa. If you happen to come into the temple using the southern gate, don't go out that way. Go out the other side. That's what the prophet tells us. When the populace comes before Hashem on the appointed days, whoever comes in by way of the northern gate to prostrate himself shall go out by way of the southern gate. And whoever comes in by the way of the southern gate shall go out by the way of the northern gate. He shall not return by way of the gate through which he came in. Rather, he should go out opposite it. Why? Why? That sounds like such a weird rule. What's the difference? You go in this door, you go in that door. No. The commentaries tell us this is a profound lesson. If you're going into the temple and you come out the exact same way you came in and nothing changed, you missed the whole point of the visit. If you go in one way, you better come out a different way because you're a different person. That's the answer, Sharon. When a person puts on the tefillin, when a person lights candles for Shabbos, and you've been doing it for decades, that feeling has to be, it's new. I'm not just going to let it be, I've been here, done that. Right? Let's be honest, right? The worst thing, the two worst expressions that we hear from teenagers are, whatever. That's one. And the other is, been there, done that. It irks me because it undermines the whole concept. They're not just saying, you know, I don't agree with that. They're undermining and saying there's nothing to what you're saying. I'm not even listening to what you're saying. Whatever. Or I really think, been there, done that. Move on. What? Are you kidding me? It can't be. You're about to do a mitzvah, right? We're going to have, God willing, we're going to light candles for tomorrow night, for Shavuos even, right? Make up your mind now that when you get ready to light your candles tomorrow, you're going to say, this is new. It's fresh. I'm going to think of something new. I'm going to excite myself, that newness, that freshness. The difference between the bar mitzvah boy who puts on tefillin for the first time and a shlub like me who's been doing it for decades is because you watch that bar mitzvah boy, he does it with such care. They're exactly 1.1 millimeter space between each strap. And he does it, and it's like, and it's so shiny, and he's beaming, and he's putting it on, and he looks in the mirror, it's straight, and he puts it down, and he starts davening, and he picks up the mirror, and he goes, wait, it moved. You know? And it's like, it's brand new to him. That's the way we should feel all the time. Is it hard? Yes. But that's what we have to strive to do. Is it any different than anything else that's important in your life? If there's something important in your life, you make sure to do it on a regular basis. How about exercise? I know, sore topic. Exercise works when you are consistent. Does it get boring? Yes, so you got to change it up the routine a little bit, but it's got to have that freshness. Why is this any different? You got to do the exercise. Do the mitzvah. It's the right thing to do. You know that. I know that. Let's do it. Oh, been there, done that. I've been lighting it for so many. Not this time. It happens to be you get two chances this week. Tomorrow night and Friday. Two chances to get it right. That's what we have to do. That's what we have to make up our minds. The fact that we can celebrate the giving of the Torah is we were given the tools to be consistent on a regular basis. Not been here, done that. Gone, Something else? No. It's the ability to continually push ourselves to find deeper meaning. I think one of the things that I strive for on a regular basis, both in my own study and what I try to convey, is to take information that I know something about and take it another level. Expand on it. Doesn't have to be a totally drastic understanding and change of it, but I never understood that aspect of it. That in and itself is new.
Frederick, here is
it's,
your
that's
mind.
The way it goes. You know, when a person, again, little secret here, right? It's not that I've never repeated the same speech twice. I have. I do believe in recycling. I'm a green kind of guy. I like that, right? However, I have found in my own experience that if I'm giving over something I've done before, I need to find one new aspect of it. If it's the same speech that I gave 10 years ago and I just have it on the paper, it doesn't come out crisp. It doesn't come out with that freshness. I don't have to rewrite the whole thing, but you know, something from 10 years ago, I've seen other things. I'm like, oh, you know what? I can add this piece to it. I didn't do that last time because I didn't know that. Now it's something new. Just needs a little something. You don't have to be drastic, but consistency, continuity with freshness. That's something the Torah gives us. Because the more you delve into Torah, the fresher it's going to get because you learn something new about it. Learn the parsha every week, right? The Torah portion of the week. I had a guy who said to me, he stopped coming to my class. He stopped coming and I asked him. He said, because it's the same story. I know Joseph's brothers are going to sell him. I know it. You don't have to tell me. I know the ending. It's like, okay, but we can learn something new about the story. Like tonight's a perfect example. When we learned about Joseph's response to his brothers, right? Did anybody hear this concept before?
No.
Amazing, right? It's now when you hear this story next year, God willing, when we read the story of Joseph and his brothers, and you're going to see that in the Torah, and you'll be like, man, I know that one. That's cool. I didn't know that before. You heard the story 100 times already, but now you have something deeper. Now you have something more, but consistency with freshness. That's what Rav Yosef, he celebrated when it came to the holiday of Shavuos. He says, it deserves to be celebrated because without it, not only would I be like everybody else in the street, but how many of me would be out there? All of my this time that. No, Torah gives me that ability to be consistent, and consistency is the name of the game. That's the insight. I think it's something we can all learn from. No matter what level we're on, it's taking it to one step further and making sure that we're not falling prey to just whatever, whatever. It flies today. It's different tomorrow. Torah gives us the ability to be consistent. What was that? Let me see what that comment was. Every time I return to Gan Eden, there have been many times, everyone's like, right, that's what it is. I mean, and Susan, that's only what I'm sharing with you. Every time I come across something, I'm like, I got to share this. It's amazing. And I've seen the story of Gan Eden, the story of Garden of Eden. I don't know. I got to say, you know, probably a few hundred times already. But it's amazing. That's my message to you, ladies and gentlemen. We have this amazing opportunity to celebrate the giving of the Torah, not just because it was the event that transformed us and made us into the people that we are, as being the ones who understand that there is a God in this world. And we're supposed to represent that godly life by the way we live it. But what an opportunity we were given. It's a privilege to have it. It's a privilege to know that we have a book that God has given us to help us be the best we can be. That's amazing. That's an amazing thing, and it deserves celebration. So on that note, I wish you each a Chag Sameach, a happy Yom Tov, a beautiful Yom Tov. If you'll spend it with your family or friends, it's a beautiful, beautiful thing. And we have the opportunity that it goes together with Shabbos. Another great opportunity, and into Memorial Day. Oh my, it's the best of everything. Have a wonderful, wonderful Yom Tov. I'm happy to answer any questions if anybody has. Yes, Liz.
Why is it a dairy meal? I mean,
all the women got together and they said, "I'm sick of serving brisket. We got to do something different." No, There's the simple answer that's given is because when we were given the Torah, so all the laws regarding kosher now became in effect, which means that they went ahead and now for them to eat meat, they would have to slaughter the animal and they would have to salt it and they had all the different. There was no way to do that on the yuntif itself. So they were left with, I guess we can't have the meat today, so I guess we'll have dairy. That's the simple understanding.
But all, when the vessels, dairy
all of the pots and pans, you know, so to say, all whatever the vessels they had to cook were treif. They had to kosher it. Because kosher didn't exist beforehand.
So was the dairy food kosher?
Well, dairy to be kosher is very simple. You take it from a cow and it's kosher.
But didn't they? But if everything they had to cook in was treif,
so you can use. I mean, have you ever made cheese before?
Not personally, no.
Oh, I have. I have. I've milked the goats, and I've and they have that cheesecloth.
Right.
It literally takes minutes. It doesn't take long at all.
Okay, so they didn't have like mac and cheese. They just had cheese.
I'm assuming it wasn't mac and cheese, right? But it was some form of dairy, and it wasn't cheesecake, and it wasn't Blintzes. I mean, unless okay. I don't know. Maybe they did something out in the sun. They cooked their eggs. Who knows?
Okay.
It could have been a cheese Blintz for all I know.
Okay.
The point being is that they didn't have the opportunity to have meat because all of the normal utensils that you need to make meat kosher were not available anymore. Okay. They all of a sudden became unusable that day.
Got it.
So therefore, they had dairy to commemorate that. That's a very simple answer. There are much, much deeper answers.
No, but that makes sense. It's like
it's a practical answer.
Right.
Correct.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Sharon.
So I've always heard that answer, and I've, accepted that answer, whatever. But the Shabbaton, somebody had said that the reason why we eat a dairy meal is because the Torah is like the mother's milk, and mother's milk gives us everything, all our nutrients, and anything that we could possibly need comes from that.
Right.
So that's why we have a dairy meal.
Correct. That's something Rabbi Horowitz shared at the Shabbaton, which is also a very beautiful.
Yeah. That's what he said.
That was a very.
I didn't want to be a name dropper.
There you go.
Yes.
What else? Excellent. Okay. That being the case, reminder, next Wednesday we are not having class because I have a wedding, thank God. But the following Wednesday, whatever that is, June 4th, whatever that next Wednesday is, June 7th. June 7th, that'll be our last class before summer break, okay? So we'll tie the whole concept of what we've been talking about, of touring the Jewish home, the importance of having a Jewish home, etc. We'll wrap that all up on the 7th, all right?
So since it's the last class, we should be going out the back door, right?
Well, hopefully you're going out. You'll just have to click the leave button or end button a little differently. Use your left hand.
And I'm not going to be able to make that class, so I don't know who here is going to take notes, so somebody has to take that up for me. Sorry, I had previous plans, so
that's
I'll
no
listen
problem,
to it.
But the good news is that if I remember, I'll actually record it, and you can listen to it and write as many notes as you want.
I know, but I'll miss everybody. I'm sure I'll see people, but I'll see people later. So.
I don't think anybody takes more copious notes than you, Robin.
I get about 5 pages each time.
Oh, so man.
Five pages, like big.
Do me a favor. Can you have it typed up in triplicate and have it on my desk by Tuesday, please?
Sure. If you want to do my hearing tomorrow morning.
I'll give you another week. Fine. No. I'd love a copy of your notes. I'm curious what I say sometimes.
Yeah. Well, we'll go through it. I don't think I could type them, but we'll take pictures or something.
Fair enough. All right. Have a great Yom Tov.